Welcome back to the Health Tech Pigeon podcast, where we break down the health tech news every single week. And this week, we unfortunately don't have any jingles for you. If you listened in last week, you would have heard Abena do the honours of singing us Let's Get Ready to Rumble by PJ and Duncan. But I am delighted to say we are joined by not just one, but two very special guests to talk us through our news and share their views for the week. So welcome, Victoria and Hassan. Thank you so much for joining us. How are you doing?
Lovely to be here. Thank you so much for inviting us. And I'm doing fine. I'm looking forward to the bank holiday. This is a very nice way to end the week.
Thank you. And I'm a big fan of the pigeon. So really, really stoked to be here.
And we are delighted, as I say, to be joined by both of you in what has been a extremely busy few weeks, not least with events, announcements, news and everything in between. So thank you for making the time. And I think with that, let's jump into our first story. So before we get into our stories for this week, I want to pick up on a conversation that we started last week, again with Abena, which was about the Equity Charter. Now, that has been the brainchild of both of you, Victoria and Hassan, I know, off the back of conversations that you had at Rewired, and obviously the inexcusable comments that we have heard from people ashamedly in this industry. So I really just want to give you the floor to tell us a bit more about it, where it came from and why, which might seem like a silly question, but why it's important. So over to you.
Thank you. Well, listen, I'll start and Hassan will jump in. So the Guardian article, I think, came out the evening before Rewired, and it reported the owner of TPP saying some really vile, racist and misogynistic comments. And we're all on a big WhatsApp group and people started talking about it. And our other colleague, Aisha Rahim, who's a doctor and clinical informatician in the NHS, posted that she thought we should write an open letter and sort of stand up and show our dismay, I guess, at the comments. And Aisha and I sort of picked up the conversation offline, and I was on my way to Rewired, and we were messaging each other and starting to draft something. And then Aisha came the next day and we spent some time in the speaker's lounge trying to put together a form of words that could the digital health community could coalesce around, sign up to. And we weren't really hearing much coming from some of the bigger institutions, so we thought this was an opportunity to bring people together. And as we were putting together our form of words, Hassan turned up fortuitously and came up with the idea of an equity charter. He was like, yes, we should say something, we should ask people to sign up to a statement, but what actually if we took it a little bit further and created something that was about something we could stand for that was positive as well as standing up to those negative comments. We got John Huxma on board, who runs Rewired, and at the end of the day he read out the statement and he gave Aisha an opportunity to talk a little bit about it on the stage. And I created a very basic Google Doc that we got people to start signing up to. And it was not fit for purpose, so we closed it down as quickly as we could, but it really got us started. And really quickly, Hassan, we got like hundreds of signatures. I think we're around 1,000 individual signatures, and we've got about 40 or 50 organisational signatures. And we've just been really pleased by the extent to which people have got involved. People have wanted to contribute to support us. And Hassan's been gathering lots of people that can give us all sorts of different types of support to try and move this agenda forward. So I'm going to pause there and maybe invite Hassan to say a bit about why this is important. And Hassan, give us your take on it.
Thank you so much. And I was really lucky that Aisha sent me a WhatsApp message saying she's going to be working on this open letter. So when I walked into the lounge, I could see the speaker's lounge, there's a buzz of energy around Victoria and Aisha. So I was drawn to it. And the reason why I thought of an equity charter, and I think initially I came up with a different title and Victoria came up with the phrase equity, is because I think the episode exposed something. When people heard the comments, universally, we were all disgusted and dismayed. What we didn't see was the people we expected to see respond. That's what we didn't see. And to be honest, I still haven't seen a lot of people respond. And there's this idea I have that if you're going to enable that behavior by not responding, by walking past it, then that's something you accept. And that's something that I didn't like. I didn't like neutrality in the face of that bigotry. And it got me thinking that there is a structural gap within our community. And I love the digital health community in this country. I think it's vibrant and I think it's full of values. But the reason why we didn't coalesce is because we had nothing to coalesce around. We didn't have a charter of our values that said this is outside of the bounds of these values. And if we do it, it has to be co-produced. It has to be co-designed and it has to be co-developed. It can't be imposed. It has to organically come from the community. That has to be those healthcare professionals, and it has to be the vendors, and it has to be NHS England and the regulators. It needs to be all of us together, the third sector. And if we do come together and say, these are our values, then I think we have a jumping off point the next time something happens. And then we can say, this is what values really mean to us. This is what equity means to us. And this is how we stand together. I was asked by a journalist whether I wanted it to be specifically about HESTA. And I said, no, to me, this is about much more than that now. This is about galvanizing a community. And this is about us responding the next time. And that's what I think this is about. This is a community coming together.
And I think just to add to what Hassan said, the charter we envisage will be about a set of values and principles. But we also want to think about what are the levers? What are the levers that we have available to us that enable us to hold ourselves to account and also vendors to account as well? So whether that be in terms of procurement or contracting or whatever, we just want to explore what are the ways in which we can act and react when something goes wrong like this as well?
I think the idea of accountability is a super interesting one. And it's something that we talked about last week with Abena, and she had a really interesting view on it, which, because we obviously live in, you know, a society, a world where cancel culture has kind of become the norm. And, you know, don't get me wrong, I think this particular situation, you know, called for people to be cancelling that behaviour is completely and utterly unacceptable. But I think she talks about having like the grace to support people to get it right. And I think by holding people to accountability is an important part of giving people the grace to get it right. I don't think it has to necessarily be about calling people out in the cancel culture. And I think that what I like about this is the sentiment of community where we all hold each other to account to do better, because we all recognise that we have an individual responsibility as well as a community responsibility, and we help each other to do better, knowing that, you know, there are times where we're human beings, we get things wrong, and it's a willingness to do better and get it right. And I really liked that ethos that kind of came from that, coupled with what Abena was saying about this idea of grace. And I think that the idea of grace in a community to support each other and always, always be aspiring to do our very best is a fantastic sentiment to have. And I think it's actually really hard, as Hassan said, to create a movement around that. And I think putting something that people can come around gives a focal point for people to focus on, and I guess a framework for us to start talking about it and think about practically what we can do, because there is an element of we do have to continue talking about it. We can't stop talking about it. We have to continue the conversation. But also then what comes next? What do we do tangibly that's different? How do we practically make positive change and do things differently? I think that's the important thing, that with grace and care within this community, it gives us a platform to be able to do that, which I really admire.
And Hassan, we've been having sort of conversations between ourselves, haven't we, about our learning, because we're not standing up and saying we know the answers and we know everything. We don't, but we're curious, and we recognise that these conversations are quite uncomfortable as well. It's difficult talking about racism and sexism, and these are complicated issues. So we really want to, I love that idea of grace, Jessica, and we do want to bring people together and go, listen, let's work some of this stuff out as a community, because it's not straightforward, but we know that we want to do better, and we know there's a gap to fill.
May I make a, this is probably an awkward comment to make, but for communities that have long been underrepresented and underserved, to continue to show grace in the face of bigotry is exhausting. And yes, of course, grace is important, but it is exhausting. And I see so many, and let's just call it out, right? I am not Black. I've had to work pretty damn hard to get to where I've got to. And I've sometimes wondered if I've had to work harder than the norm, but I know for a fact my Black friends have had to work much harder than me. So there is a structural problem with racism, and we do need to be even more careful about how we call it out. The fact that such comments were not called out immediately at the intersection of Black people and women, that's a bad thing. And that, to me, that motivated, that animated me to think, I need to step forward. Now, and I'm not really calling for a movement so much. I'm calling for a limited movement, only because a community, in my eyes, is a group of people who are bound by something. And I still don't think we're really clear what we're bound by. So if I can get some clarity on what we're bound by, I'll pull back. I don't need it to go any further. For me, I just want to make sure our community is stronger and healthier, that it can respond to the infection the next time it happens. That's what I'm looking for.
I guess one thing, like, about the comments is not necessarily just the comments themselves, as horrendous as they were, but I guess to your point about no one responding, he also felt comfortable to say that out loud in a room full of people. And I think that also speaks volumes about the people that were around him in that space that basically gave him permission to say those things. And so actually they're as culpable as he is in many ways. And I think, you know, we're covering it this week in the newsletter that finally NHS England is reviewing contracts over suppliers' racist comments. It kind of seems a little bit too little too late, and hopefully, you know, something comes of that. But you're right, it speaks of a bigger issue. And I think that, you know, there are also lots of us who have been able to benefit from a great deal of privilege. You have a responsibility to be active and use that privilege in a positive way, I think. Because, you know, to Hassan's point, it shouldn't be carried on the shoulders of people who deserve better support and actually just deserve better and shouldn't have to work harder than, you know, other counterparts and colleagues in the community and in the ecosystem.
Thank you so much, Jess. And I want to add something here that I was struck by a definition. Someone told me an ally, and I've always thought an ally was a good thing. An ally is someone helping someone else with their problem. And a champion is someone who takes that problem as their own. And I've always wanted to be a champion rather than an ally. And I saw during this episode, people who didn't step up to allyship. And that was bad. That helped me see a distinction here. Now, I'm not picking out any names. I think every one of us have got our own unique circumstances. And sometimes we can't step into the political sphere. I don't think this is political, to be honest. I think this is another level. But I also think there's a responsibility of people in positions of authority to think carefully about how their silence is viewed, because it actually enables the bully. And that's what I was really animated by. I was animated by a bully. I didn't like that. And I don't think any of us should like that. So when I ask people to go onto the website, if you don't mind, I'll just repeat it, equitycharter.digital. And we're still ready for anyone to sign up to the open letter. If you sign up, you'll see that we are saying it's not okay to be neutral in the face of that bigotry. That's what we're saying. And then commit to co-developing and co-designing something together as a charter for the community for us to move forward. And for me, that's a really easy letter to sign. And I'm really glad that the Royal College of GPs, that NHS Confed, that NHS providers, we've got CEO.
And actually, you know, it's in all our interest to have a diverse, creative tech sector, you know, and thinking about the ramifications, those sort of ramifications of those sorts of comments for the people that work in digital health, we will get better products, better tools, better services if we have diverse people building them and they're safe places to work, that we'll get the best talent, the best people. And it's the same in our NHS. We have a very diverse NHS and we need it to be a safe place for people to work so that we can serve diverse communities. So there's a really, you know, there's a really practical reason why all of us should care about this.
I actually find it really difficult to talk about some of this because I present as white. I'm not black. My dad is black. And I have Jessica and I have been talking about this recently because we're getting married and Jess wants to take my name. And I've been talking to her about like some of the connotations of having a name that isn't English and actually what that means and what that, you know, just sort of things about my childhood and all the rest of it and how it makes you feel. These sort of comments, and actually some of the comments that have happened since by friends of Hester, to call this out, Lord Maryland, a businessman and Tory donor who says he knows Hester, says he's not racist because he travels widely overseas. He does business in Jamaica. He does business in Malaysia. So he's not a racist. There are these like, these comments that are then further backed up by certain people in places of authority remind people that they are the other and that it's not a place of belonging. And Victoria, you mentioned, you know, the benefits of diversity, but you also mentioned the importance of places feeling safe so that diversity can exist in its truest form, I guess, and provide the value to a community. And it's comments like this that are then backed up by other comments that then, I don't know, it just ends up like, it ends up reminding such a huge number of the population that they are the other. And that stifles all of that feeling of diversity and all of those benefits from it, because it when I read that stuff, it even makes people like me, who in some way have no real claim to this, but like even I just go a bit quiet and I'm like, oh yeah, my dad was the other and I've seen like, and it reminds me of all that sort of stuff, and then it affects my confidence in a small way. I'm not trying to claim this is anything to do with me, but that's why this equity charter is important, because I think that when you therefore are declaring what the community's values are, when these things happen and people do feel individually either victimized or that they've lost confidence or whatever they feel that is negative when comments like this come out, it's not just them that they don't have to deal with that individually necessarily. And of course they will be to some degree, but at least you're part of a community that has a movement behind it that is diverse, that does contain people that are not just like you, that are like everyone. And I don't know, there's something about the feeling of this equity charter for me that goes beyond just a list of names that puts pressure and does lobbying and all the rest of it. Like that, it's not just that for me. I think there's a different point to it that I think will make more of a difference than you think.
I couldn't agree more, James. And thank you so much for saying it. It means a lot when someone sees beyond just the title and thinks deeper about the intention here. So forgive me, there's four words that we often use, but I think they're not interchangeable. We talk about equality, and for me, equality is about the law. We talk about diversity, and diversity is about having common values, being diverse outside of those values, but having the common values. Inclusion is an effort, right? But the inclusion has an outcome, which is the last word, which is belonging. And here's the problem. I don't think those comments belong. And that's why we need to have a statement of the community's values in a charter. That means we can then say what belongs and what doesn't. Because inclusion only works when you can say you belong, we belong, and this is why we belong, because we share those values. So equality, diversity, inclusion, and belonging, they're a sequence. They're a linear sequence. You need the equality, the legal part first. You need the diversity, then you need the effort, then you need the outcome. And that's why belonging is so important. And that's really at the heart of the charter.
Yeah, that was beautiful. You put that really nicely, Hassan. Thank you so much for saying that, James, because if it does have the effect that people can feel, you know, that there's a place to go, there are people that care about these sorts of issues, that there are people willing to stand up, then, you know, I really hope that has some sort of impact. And we don't know where this is going to go. We're thinking about the charter, and we're going to run a workshop and bring people together. And we want to give an opportunity for everyone that signed up to make a contribution as well. We're having a think about how to do that. But who knows where this goes next? And we've been running at 100 miles an hour, just trying to keep up with ourselves on top of our day jobs on this. But, you know, it would be great if we can create something out of this that really has a positive impact.
Absolutely. And we've had lots of offers of help. You know, we had some pro bono legal advice from Bevan Britton. The website was done by Bloom Health. You know, people have come in and said, we'll help you convene the workshop. You know, we are open to people joining us to do this together so that it becomes something we're all proud of. So this is really a call to a community. How do we do this well?
Well, there you have it. There's a call to action for us all there. First of all, if you haven't already, sign the Equity Charter. And second of all, if there's something that you can do to help, then get in touch with Hassan or Victoria and see how you can get more actively involved in keeping this momentum going and making active change and just making this space better for everyone who is in it so that it serves everyone who is in it, because that's the most important thing. So yeah, thank you so much for taking the time to share that with us. We are so, so grateful. All right, well, moving on to our news, which seems far less interesting than all of the topics we've already covered so far. But we are keen to get your views on some of the stories that we have in Pigeon this week. So I want to start with our first article, which is from Med City News. And it is a summary from a panel at HIMSS asking what digital transformation means to three system execs. Now, I'll be honest, The three headlines or subheads, should I say here, the summary is, it's about tapping into the power of data, it's about moving to the cloud, and it's about being agile. Now, I think that's all well and good, and I'm sure the panel was super interesting, but as we have two of our very own execs here, I'm more interested in hearing from them what digital transformation means to you.
I often think that digital transformation is just a code word for we're going to buy some tech and impose it on you, and you've got to work it out. and it's done by people who have no understanding of the human factors behind why we do things. And I've used that phrase carefully because it's the phrase that we use in the literature. It's the phrase that's in the practitioner's handbooks. Mm. Right. We aren't just talking about the clinical value or the economic value. We're talking about the human being at the center of the change. And it is about change. And so let me be clear, right? If you have a surgical implement that is going to save money and improve complication rates, but it means that the surgeon has to go home 3 hours later, that's a human factor. If you're going to ask a group of, shall we say, in a primary care clinic, and you're going to ask the reception team to, I don't know, load up 8,000 student registrations every September, and you're going to make them do it manually and they have to do it on the weekends, that's a human factor, right? And if we don't consider the human at the center of this, then there's no transformation, there's no change, there's no productivity, there's no cash releasing efficiency, and there's no return on investment. Benefits realization, all of that goes out the window. And that's why really it isn't about being agile and the cloud and data. Throw all of that in the bin. It's about the human.
I love that. I think we were at a panel earlier this week with Tortoise. They were talking about the future of healthcare. And there was a conversation, as there always is, you know, is AI going to cause people to lose their jobs? Is it going to create redundancies? And I really loved the response of one of the panelists, and I forget which one it was who said it, but they said that yes, it will create redundancies, but not of people. It will be redundancies of process. And they likened it to electric cars, for example. They said, think about your experience of driving an electric car, how you even get into the car. You don't use the key anymore. You don't go to the petrol station. It creates so many efficiencies in that process that it makes that far more enjoyable and far more efficient. And that's what AI will be like. But ultimately, AI will be like in the context of healthcare, but ultimately healthcare is built on a foundation of humanity, and people will always be required. Healthcare requires that human touch. And actually, particularly when we look at the scenario that we're in right now, there aren't enough people. So the purpose it serves is to make best use of the people that we do have and allowing them to get back to the human connection and take away all the additional burden that stops them doing the jobs that really they signed up to do. So I really like that actually it comes back to people at the end of the day, because I think that's, it's easy to get caught up in the sparkly technology. And, you know, we often see, you know, technology being sort of parachuted in and assume that it's going to make this huge difference. But actually, it's the people using the technology that's going to make the difference, not the technology itself.
Absolutely. And to follow the parachute analogy, sorry, I would just say that it's so the parachute hasn't actually deployed. So you're just getting a box. And that's how it feels. Can I just say one more thing? And I think you've opened a window in my mind with your comment, Jess. When I think of a process that doesn't have any disruption yet, doesn't have any technology yet, I think sometimes technology becomes additive. Instead of it becoming seven steps, it becomes nine. Or one of those steps gets longer. The process is actually worse as a result of what people do. That's why transformation often fails. And I think we have to consider how we're substitutive or deletive. Can I remove something, or can I swap them around and the whole thing condenses? And that for me is the value of technology, not just AI, but any technology onto a workflow, which really in the simplest terms is what we're trying to achieve with digital health. Otherwise, it's vanity.
What about you, Victoria? Do you agree?
Well, I'm going to violently agree with Hassan.
I was hoping for a debate here.
I know, I'm so sorry. I'll try and add something to it, but I can't disagree. Listen, I'm a social worker. I'm a social scientist. Of course, I agree. As you were speaking, Hassan, you reminded me, I sat in a panel a few years ago with a doctor, and he said, every time I get sold a new piece of technology, I'm told it's going to make my life easier. And every time it makes my life harder. And I think when we treat digital as a commodity, rather than thinking about it in its context as an enabler of transformation and positive change, that's where we do end up adding loads of extra steps, extra work. And we don't spend enough time trying to understand the problem we're trying to solve in the first place and who it's a problem for. So you won't be surprised, as someone that specializes in user-centered design, when I think about digital transformation, I think about how do we understand the problem we're trying to solve and how do we use methods to do that? How do we engage our users? How do we spend time with them, observing their work, interviewing them, understanding what works, what doesn't work? And then how do we take them through the whole process so that their needs and their goals and ultimately actually patient experience and patient outcomes are at the heart of anything we're doing around digital? Digital tends to get sort of fetishized and put at the forefront, whereas, of course, and I know we say this again and again, but it should just be the enabler. And we should be thinking about organizational transformation, about clinical transformation, about patient outcomes, patient experience, and how can technology enable us to achieve those goals. And I just think we're out of whack with it. And I think I'm starting to see now digital teams incorporate user researchers, service designers. And where they do that, they put the effort in up front to really achieve those benefits further down the line, because you take people with you.
Yeah, I think the SaaS tech boom has got quite a lot to answer for in other sectors, because it seems like we've had this like explosion of like SaaS platforms and all the rest of it, creating these like wild efficiencies in industries that, let's just say, don't necessarily need a human in the loop, or I mean, lots of different things down that route. But it feels like we're under pressure in healthcare sometimes. I think we're under pressure to automate things. We're under pressure to drop all of this process and all the rest of it. And I think to your points, like in healthcare, it is a little bit different. Of course, there are processes that are nowhere near patients, that are back office, that are admin, that yes, okay, there can be, you know, many process wins there, but there are so many parts of healthcare where these processes are going to come close to the clinical ground floor or even onto the clinical ground floor. And in organizations that require empathy to patients, that run off the back of goodwill with staff and people giving their time and all these things, I guess what I'm hearing from both of you is kind of how I feel, that we need to accept that there's something else that needs to be considered here. Like, where are the points at which humans fit in? And indeed, I like what you're saying about, you can't just drop a process into a group of humans and expect that group of humans to adopt it. That is unreasonable. It is unfair. And it ends up in a worse place. I mean, dare I say the word adoption at this point as well? Like, the focus on adoption is, it's something that comes and goes in terms of how much we end up talking about it. But I think in the way that we're talking about it here, it sounds like the best digital transformation will have this empathy towards the humans, whether the process is touching them as a patient or whether it's a human that has to be involved in it. But the right digital transformation will have that empathy towards those humans. And actually, it's built around the humans that are either in the loop running the process or indeed affected by it as a patient. And it needs to be that understanding from the start. It needs to be an IQ and an EQ process right from the start. And that is digital transformation. And I think we can put ourselves under pressure to, you know, adopt the latest tech and this latest LLMs. They're going to, like, let's put them everywhere. Let's make everything reductive. Let's reduce all processes because of LLMs. I think you'll both know, like, at the end of the day, we could just be sending text messages to people and actually making a lot of ground and a lot of benefit, or we could be using something else that is not anywhere near towards quantum computing to actually make a difference. We don't need to put ourselves under the pressure necessarily to adopt this crazy wild technology. It's just a case of building the right processes with the right technology that just get us a bit further down the line than we are now, and just relieve people of something right now. It seems like that's what you're both saying anyway, if I've got that right.
Can I add something? Because I loved what you just said there, James, right? I think you said that the EQ and the IQ at the beginning, what I really want to see is a vendor or an innovator having the EQ in the middle and at the end, because I want to co-produce and co-develop. So come to my facility, come to my workflow, understand why my way of doing things might be subtly different. For example, just because you've got a Cerner instance doesn't mean it's going to be the same as another institution that also has a Cerner instance, or TPP or whatever it's going to be. As long as you understand me in context and what's going to happen around me, that's where we can get things done, not just at the beginning when you're making the product, but when you're helping me adopt it. And the adoption phase is I think, the barrier to scale. That's why we don't see companies achieving mass scale in digital health, because they fail to get the product market fit that comes from the adoption. And that's what we really want to focus on.
I also think the language of productivity and efficiency is such sort of transactional industrial language as well. And I think if we want to take people with us, if we want to engage clinicians and people working in the NHS, for example, then talking about quality, talking about meaning, talking about human factors, those are the things ultimately that we care about. And I just worry sometimes we just get so reductive and transactional that it doesn't excite the people that have to do the adopting and make these things work in practice.
I have a question, which is based on what you just said, actually, Hassan. Do you think it is actually possible for large scale, you talked about large scale and adoption, right? Do you think it's possible for large scale by one company and one product across an entire nation of clinical organizations? Do you think that's actually possible? And the reason I ask is because essentially that is the conversation being had at every single meeting for VC money. because everyone is presenting to a VC that wants to put a product in clinical areas anyway, basically saying, I can get this scaled everywhere, and I can get it scaled in the US, and probably a bit in Europe and Australia. So based on the fact that you've just said, like, the customization per site is actually incredibly difficult. Like, and I get this is a generalized question, but you kind of see why I'm asking you, right? Do you think that's actually possible?
I can tell you why it's not possible now and how to make it possible. So the reason why it's not, possible now is because we don't have the same delivery system across all of them. We don't have train tracks for you to put the carriage onto in all of these places. It's a bit like asking everybody in the world, you've all got your own different type of smartphone and there isn't an app store. So how do I get an app onto all of these phones? The standardization of those that enables us to have an app store and SDK where I can download, whether I'm Google or iOS, and I can download apps directly onto my handset. That's what you're looking for. So the real winner, I think, in the VC language of the J curve and the power law is going to be the picks and shovels plays that say, I'm going to put some infrastructure into many places that will enable others to be able to ride on my back. And if you get that done, that's where the money play is. But to say that I'm a very small but very useful thing and I've got to fight to get into a budget, fight to get into clinical, fight to get into regulation and make sure that every single different place in the world wants me, I don't think that's serious. And that's why a lot of VCs are saying they're a bit worried about people claiming that they're going to get to mass scale by using the NHS as their vehicle. Mm.
And Victoria, for those companies or entrepreneurs or anyone really that's trying to get this done, what is your advice to them? Respecting that it's difficult to get adopted into these areas, respecting that often the organization wants to be digitally transformed, it's still important for those innovators that are going into those areas to behave properly, to say the right things, to have the right approach. Like, what is that correct approach?
Yeah, I mean, there are so many barriers and there are a lot of commercial barriers as well around how things get bought or not bought. But I guess Hassan's point about product market fit is really salient. So, and I think that's a really tricky thing for small startups to do. They need to work out whether they're solving a problem, but solving the problem is not enough. They've also got to create value in a number of different ways. So they've got to create value to the patient, if it's patient facing, value to the clinician. They've also got to be something that can be procured and easily bought. And then they've got to think about all the potential integrations, which are going to be really potentially tricky to do. So I think I really encourage startups to do their homework. I think there's a lot of naivety out there. And I think, you know, it's a cliche, but people often do think that the NHS is one big organisation and they don't understand it's a sea of piranhas out there. And so I think spending time with clinicians, I think actually the best startups have a clinician, a really good clinician, a really good tech person, and someone who's really good on evidence as well. But I think it's tough out there for people, to be honest.
Yeah, on the NHS side, you've written a few blogs on like user-centered design from, I guess, the NHS angle as well. Like, for those organisations, what's important for them in order to get themselves into a place to be digitally transformed or to approach digital transformation in the right way? Basically, like, what's the summary of those all three blogs so we don't have to go read them all?
So from an NHS point of view, from an adopter point of view?
Yeah.
So listen, Eve, we often talk about cookie cutting when we're talking about scale, we get it adopted here and go there, but very little is codified. Every clinical workflow is slightly different. Every context is different. The culture's different. The leadership's different. The constraints, the opportunities. So I think you need to do that groundwork every time you deploy a technology, and you need to understand how something works in a context, understand the context, understand that workflow, understand the pathways, and then understand how they might be redesigned to incorporate a technology so that its impact can be understood and maximized. And so you don't add those extra steps and extra workload by plonking it in. So any service or organization that's looking at a piece of software that it wants to deploy needs to do that work, in my view, and they need to do that user-centered design piece. They need to engage their stakeholders, understand what's important to them. It might even be something about people's professional identity, their values, their beliefs. There are so many things that are around human factors that can scupper an implementation. And I have definitely spent time with, for example, groups of nurses who have been told to deploy a technology and they don't want to, so it doesn't happen. So at your peril, don't pay attention to the clinicians that you need to engage with and need to adopt your technology.
Professional identity bit, that is so interesting, the professional identity bit, because yes, I can recall something trying to be put through in one of my hospitals when I was a junior doctor. And it was like, hold on a minute. No, that's my job. That's what I do. That's how I connect with that patient when they book in. Or yeah, it really threatened the identity of you know, an individual job in that hospital, and those people that held that job, like, all came together and just said, like, we're not actually doing this. Now, it's interesting because their motive was actually, we're going to degrade the relationship between us and that patient, because actually that's something that we need to do in order to build the relationship. And so they've got the best quality of healthcare at heart. They're not just trying to slow the system down for no reason. They're not just being like, you know, bloody minded. They're not just trying to, like, you know, stick their feet in and stick their heels in and inertia. They're not trying to do that. They're not afraid of change necessarily in that scenario. They're actually just trying to protect the best wishes of the patient and the best quality of care. And so you're right, like, that piece of work doesn't sound just like a, you know, let's do a quick questionnaire. No, you're talking about like a real piece of work to understand the inner workings of the entire department. And the buckets that you mentioned, actually, like people, leadership, culture, like, these words are interesting, because this is a very sort of qualitative analysis, isn't it, of quite a lot of different things, and requires then a strategy of implementation of a piece of tech that's actually far beyond, like, oh, well, okay, let's put it in on a Tuesday because that's when so-and-so's in and they're pretty good with tech. Like, they're good on their iPhone. It's, again, like, the implementation's got to be a bit more than that, hasn't it?
It really has. And you have to give people time to sense make. And I think it's often not understood that because different professional groups are accountable to their organisation, but they're also accountable to their professional bodies and through their training,
yeah,
you can't tell people what to do in quite the same way that you might be able to do in other industries.
I blame, and I'm going to say this on your podcast, I'm very sorry, I'm going to start a fight here. I blame the EPR vendors, because they went in and became the heartbeat of the hospital. They integrated into all the systems, and then they made it almost impossible for all of the smaller, interesting, agile, nimble vendors to get onto the back of them. Now, you can talk about the app orchard or whatever Epic wants to call it, but we all know it's a waste of time. We all know they make it difficult. We all know it's not easy. And now I think the disruption of the EPR model has to be something that we take on very seriously as an agenda point in healthcare. It's not about, well, do I buy another Cerner instance or a System C instance? It should be thinking, do we have an information infrastructure, which is the World Health Organization calling it infrastructure, where we have modular systems which are all switchable, and those modular systems are built open. And it means then that you have the ability to change things very flexibly according to what you need. And information is the actual backbone of it all. That's where I think we need to move to. And then vendors are going to find it very easy to bring their deep tech in. And we're currently in what I think is the third wave of digital health. You know, the first wave was very, very simple stuff. The second wave is stuff that tried to be more interesting. And the third wave is more deep tech, generative AI, precision medicine. We're in that third wave. And that tech deserves to be there. The patients need it. Our healthcare workforce needs it. And if our systems and our infrastructure don't enable them to get on, then we should change the infrastructure.
It's hard to make the case for great new tech when people's everyday experience with their EPR is usually pretty rubbish. You know, it's a big contributor to staff burnout, you know, having to enter data into multiple systems, duplication, bad UX, and so on.
Yeah. And actually, to bring this sort of full circle here, we were talking about the equity charter to begin with. We were talking about a set of principles to begin with that would unite a community of those of us in digital health, health tech, whatever you want to call it, but a set of principles that everyone sort of agrees to that means the community moves forward. You know, when you have that sort of open versus closed debate and you have the potential for a technology to infiltrate the entire clinical ground floor only to then close its doors to further innovation, you know, I wonder, when that was being tabled and something like an equity charter were in place with a set of values, whether or not actually a community stands up and goes, hold on a minute, there might be some innovations in future that this blocks. I wonder if, you know, just to, I don't know how you feel about that, Hassan, but like, I wonder if, you know, this equity charter then has ramifications down the road that, you know, perhaps go even beyond what we were talking about into this sort of territory of actually, like, can we prevent the stifling of innovation with a set of values down the line? Can we prevent monopolies? Can we prevent these types of things that, you know, just help us all move forward? And we're back to community again, aren't we? We're back to the value of community here and the whole reason that a lot of us, you know, run the companies the way that we do. But yeah, I don't know if you've got a comment on
that. So when I look at Open Air, for example, and I look at Professor Rachel Dunscombe, who is someone I look up to for being a wonderful human being, as well as being an absolute genius, right? She's a legend. And I see what she's talking about, and it just makes so much sense. You know, instead of collecting all of this information in different ways and then trying to normalize it with some natural language processing and trying to get it all into the format that means we can now apply machine readable or AI or data driven onto it, just collect it in a standardized format, just standardize it, right? And that goes back to the point I made around having train tracks or having something that means we have a uniformity, and that uniformity enables innovation. This is a paradox, but unless you have some standardization in the first place, you can't have innovation. It's us like having 3-pin plugs or USBs. And it's enabling you to go further. And we don't have the standardization. And it's because EPR companies and others, they profit from saying it's proprietary, it's ours, it's the way we do things. And absolutely, I'd love a community to make a statement to say, no, we actually, you've held us hostage for too long. Get lost. And yes. We're not in a position to be able to tell everyone to get lost. That is a problem here, right? We are in a slightly odd, and I can be spiky. I can afford to be spiky. But if you're an NHS CIO, you do have to work alongside your vendor. But I do think that answer for us is to take this community to another level. It begins with values. And I think it does end up with a vision of where we want to be.
So yes, we've definitely gone full circle. It started with the equity charter. It's finished with the equity charter. And actually it's proved that there is, I guess, not only a place for this equity charter in health tech, but it seems like there's almost a vacuum for this equity charter in digital health. It seems to fulfill a role that, you know, someone in this, you know, I've been in this space a long time actually, and there's always been certain things that happen that you can't quite put your finger on why they make you uncomfortable or why they're not quite right, but it is values. And actually, Hassan, you're right. Like, you and I, we've been in this space a long time, and you perhaps even longer than I have. And I think as a member of the community that is not afraid to stand up and you know, argue for what you believe in, you've made a heck of a name for yourself, and rightly so. I hope that the Equity Charter is successful. I hope that with the support of us as much as we can and with others, that it does provide a community for people. It provides hope for people. It provides people with something that they can feel at home in, that they have shared values with. And I'll do my best to support you, mate, with both of you, in fact, with what you're trying to do with this, because I think it's very badly needed. Before I let you go, starting with Victoria, why don't you just give us a quick rundown of what you're up to, and if you've got any asks of our wonderful audience.
Oh, gosh. Well, it feels like life begins and ends with Equity Charter at the moment. But I tell you what, I have got an ask, actually. I have developed a really lovely training programme for digital teams in the NHS and in social care called Digital Transformation by Design. And I deliver it with my lovely service design colleague, Philippa. And we've been delivering it to lots of digital teams, to clinical leaders in the digital space, to shared care record teams. And we're always keen to deliver it to more people. So yeah, if anyone's interested, then we're digitalby.design, so check us out. And I'm currently got my head immersed in EPRs, Hassan will be pleased to hear, because I'm writing a paper for the Frontline Digitisation Programme on how you get good working relationships between vendors and the NHS when it comes to EPRs. So it's super, super fascinating. I've been running a workshop with a load of NHS procurement and contracting people today. So that's my life at the moment, James. And I'm looking forward to having a break from it over the next few days.
Excellent.
So for me, I've got a massive ask. I'm really lucky to be a lecturer at UCL, and the reason why I think I'm lucky is because I get to work with postgraduate students from all over the world at the world's first and only business school for healthcare. It's called the Global Business School for Health, and I'm module lead on startups on the Masters of Digital Health and Entrepreneurship, and I'm also attached to the MBA Health on Contemporary Issues and Innovation. So I put out a call actually just today asking for help. Do you have jobs? Do you have internships? Do you have opportunities to shadow? I've got people who, this is their third degree, you know, I've got medical students in there. I've got all sorts of people, amazing people, right? And some of them are thinking, how do I get to the market? How do I even get a consulting project for my MBA? Those are the kind of conversations that are coming up. So that was a big ask. An announcement that's worth making is that King's now has the London Institute for Healthcare Engineering, LIHEI, which has announced the UK's first medtech venture builder. And that's important. So if you have early stage medtech, which includes software as a medical device, then you can get a grant if you're a spin out. It's free because of Research England grant, and you can end up with a 12-month program that will do the commercial translation. It will get you from your idea all the way to having an enterprise. Introductions to all of the right people in all the right institutions. I think those two are my big asks.
Beautiful. Thank you both so much. We are so lucky to have two incredible health tech leaders on our podcast this week. And for those of you listening, it started with Jess hosting and it finished with me hosting, and you didn't even notice. So thank you all for listening. We are going to be back with you. By the way, that's because Jess had to jump off the call. It's not because I just randomly took over hosting, just to get that in there. But yes, we will be back with you next week talking about all the health tech news. So thank you very much. If you want to get the newsletter to grab all the links to those stories, head to healthtechpigeon.com. And what else are we doing? We're also launching a little cheeky biotech one. Biotech Dodo is the rumor. So stay tuned for that. We'll see you next week.